organic farmers no longer can grow soybeans back home. It's all contaminated. Our choice has been taken away. What right has any company got, or what right has any individual have to destroy the property of others by introducing a substance or a life form that will destroy the property of others? No one should have that right. So my choice has been taken away with the introduction of GMOs. So there is no such thing as coexistence. Our choice is gone. And it doesn't only apply to the crops that GMOs are put into originally. Canola comes from the brassica family. It's got close relatives and distant relatives, but close relatives, radishes, turnips, and so on. Wild cousins or distant cousins like wild mustard. It is now cross-pollinating into those crops. Again, we'll be destroying future crops that organic farmers no longer can grow. What is the big fear now? The introduction of GMO wheat. And Monsanto has applied in both our countries for the introduction for regulatory approval of GMO wheat. And if that comes about, it would totally destroy the organic farmers. Wheat comes from the grass family. And it would be an economic issue. I have not touched on that. We've lost. We cannot sell one bushel of canola to the European Union. We've lost. Most countries of the world will not buy canola from us because it's all contaminated. If wheat comes out, 90% of, or 80, over 80% of our customers told us we will not buy GMO wheat from you. So the economic issue would be devastating. Now, in the Supreme Court, when they hear this case, there will be many issues they will be addressing. First of all, the patenting of life forms. There will be the liability issue, I believe. There will be issue of whether farmers will always maintain the right to use their own seed. But most of all, the most important, and this is what I was told yesterday, or the day before I left, is that by legal people, that there is a strong possibility that Monsanto will lose their rights to their patent. And that will be one of the greatest things, that they will not be able to patent or lose their patent on wheat and canola. I think I've spoken long enough, but I'd like to say a few more things. Is that, as I said, it has not been easy to stand up to a company. And I think all of us have to give a commitment. And there's a lot of younger generation people here. I'm 72 years of age. My wife is 71. And we don't know how many good years we got left. But we know the good years we got left, that we will go down fighting for the rights of farmers always to be able to use their own seed. Thank you.
Percy Schmeiser, Canadian canola farmer, double victim of the Monsanto Corporation. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests.
Robert Shapiro, well, he's our hero. He's on a mission with a vision of sustainability, which means we're going to keep on growing till we're the biggest corporation in the 21st century. In the future, for the big polluters, span an eco-friendly line and redesigning DNA genetic eyes on that far horizon where everything alive is privatized and every seed will pay. We got the soya, we got the lawyers, the politicians in our pockets, all the way to president, the press and TV to guarantee the cooperation of your nation in our new experiment. You did not choose it, but you'll have to use it. We'll get our Roundup ready fingerprint in every pie you eat with a bit latent, be a bit more blatant. Tell a corporation's domination of your global be complete. Mr. Monsanto, Monster Mutanto, we're turning Satan into Samson. Give everybody cancer coming through now. We're changing you now. The Mother Nature Terminators, Hell on Earth Creators, Gene Manipulators, Biotech Dictators.
Food and health and hope.
Seize the Day, the Monsanto Song. We'll conclude the program with a speech by Dr. Vandana Shiva of India, which was recorded earlier this year at the EcoFarm Conference in Asilomar, California. One of the organizers introduces Dr. Shiva.
Globalization and corporate control is taking ownership of seeds from farmers and forcing them to use non-savable patented GMO varieties. This and other factors that lead farms away from local control is contributing to the leading cause of death on farms in the United States and other countries such as India. That's suicide. Farmers unable to control the basic germplasm and losing the ability to provide for their families are in turn losing hope and faith and literally killing themselves. There are very few champions for these and all small farmers, but today we're honored to have hopefully two heroes of the common people here to give us an update and some hope. Our first speaker, Dr. Vandana Shiva, is a physicist, an ecologist, an activist, an editor, and author of many books. And I probably wouldn't be able to begin to tell you all the things she's done. She directs the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. Under this foundation, Dr. Shiva created the Bija Vidyapeeth.
Bija.
The International College for Sustainable Living, and also Divine Women for Diversity, which is a global campaign having biodiversity, cultural diversity, and food security as the main focuses. To date, she has written 22 books that bring to light the struggle of Native peoples against huge corporate giants taking over and privatizing basic resources. Her most recent book concerning the corporate takeover of Native vegetative resources is Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. She has written several other books about the corporate takeover of world water supplies. She was one of the main inspirations of the Fatal Harvest book, comparing sustainable and conventional agriculture systems. She travels extensively and is sure to be on hand wherever in the world small farmers are being oppressed. I'm truly honored to introduce a longtime hero of mine, Dr. Vandana Shiva.
If I wasn't with you, what I'd have been doing is working on trying to continue to have the truth about GMOs established in India, because one thing we've learned in the GMO story, I've never had to tell the truth so many times over just to stay heard. Biotechnology kind of changed my life track, and I followed the corporations that were bringing us products that no one seemed to want. Scientifically evaluated, they weren't at any point doing a better job, whether of managing pests or weeds or of providing more food. And in the now literally 15 years I've been working on GMO issues, I've seen the tactics change, and I think it might be a little interesting for you see how it's changed. In the early days, it used to be the CEOs who used to come out to debate with us, you know, the Robert Shapiros, etc., because it was believed that the power of these white guys would silence the rest of us. And it didn't. So the next round, they started to hire women from the environment movement to be their public relations spokesman. And that didn't work either. You know, I think everyone had a job for 1 year or 2 years, and then that was over. They then reached the stage where they found third worlders who were willing to sell biotechnology and sell untruths about it. And for some of you who might not know where those names come from, I think I should mention it. You know, last year I was visiting Patagonia, a clothing company. And they had started a big GM campaign. And they said, we gave it up because we had such attacks from third worlders. And they started to read out letters. I said, that's Florence Wambugo of Kenya. They read out another letter. I said, that's C.S. Prakash of Tuskegee University. They said, how do you know? I said, they've got 5 people in their pay. That's about it. And we've got thousands not paid. Yeah? And I think it's time we all knew the names of the people who are planted to speak falsely on behalf of the third world. So remember the name of Florence Wambugo of Kenya. She works for BIO, which is the Biotechnology Industry Organization. Remember the name of C.S. Prakash, who's flown anywhere in the world to speak on behalf of, again, the third world. The latest tactics, of course, is capture the agencies of the third world. So that every ministry in my country, whether it's the biotechnology department or the environment ministry or agriculture ministry, that a year or 2 years ago was with us in the courts fighting these companies, is today with the companies fighting us. But that's part of the power of the corruption that can be achieved. So I want to tell you in detail what is the truth about biotechnology right now and what's the false propaganda that is keeping a failed technology alive. And failing corporations have their last gasp. I think around the world it's becoming very, very clear that the only way in which biotechnology is spreading is through coercion, not through free choice. Wherever there's free choice, for example, consumers can choose the food they want when they go to buy. There's no place in the world where consumers are choosing and saying, I want GM food. If they don't have the information, they might be eating it without consent, without information. But in every country where consumers got organized and started to have a say in what kind of food they'd be eating, GMOs haven't made it to the table. Not in Europe, not in Japan. Even in India, every time we can formally test, we manage to get a ban. For example, the Indian Agency for Genetic Engineering has just sent back 10,000 tons of corn that was meant for food aid because they couldn't guarantee it didn't have Starlink in it. The coercion element through which GMOs are spreading is coming on the one hand with respect to farmers, where farmers who've lost their choice because of indebtedness and debt traps, when they're brought the new seeds, that's the seeds they have to plant. The credit is linked to it. The entire structure of control is linked to it. The deception is linked to it. In the case of India, our organization has monitored right from day one what has happened with the changes in seed policy laws. 90% of our seed a decade ago used to be farmer-safe seed. 10% used to come from public sector seed supply. Most of it open pollinated. About the only hybrid seed we had was a little bit in vegetables and flowers. That's it. But in food staples, there were no hybrids. And there were no corporations. Globalization changed, forced us to change our policy and allow the big corporations to enter. Cargill was the first and Monsanto, and then Monsanto bought up Cargill, as you know. The way they trap Indian farmers into GM seed, and that is the case for farmers anywhere, is they first do a very large-scale seed replacement with hybrid. And once farmers have seed that they can't save and have to buy the seed every year, after they've got farmers dependent on hybrids, they then get them dependent on the GM seed. In India, the GM seeds entered illegally. 1998, Monsanto brought BT cotton for trials, violating every law. We have a law. I mean, US doesn't have a law to regulate GMOs. We have a law to regulate GMOs. And I believe it must have been the kind of scientists who gathered here in this conference center in 1972. You remember? The self-imposed ban by scientists on genetic engineering was right here in the place where we are meeting. And the founders of genetic engineering said, here's a very risky technology. We've learned how to create transgenics. We've learned how to splice genes, but we don't know the consequences, so let's call for a moratorium. And scientists called for a moratorium, but venture capital firms were formed. A few scientists moved into those, started to make big bucks, and responsibility in science was totally forgotten. But around that time, some responsible scientists in India got together and started to make framework laws. And our laws require imports of GMOs to be cleared by an environmental body, the deliberate release into the environment to be cleared by this body, and at every stage, there's supposed to be regulation. But Monsanto had got so used to pushing GMOs without anyone's permission in this country, they thought they were going to do that with us. So we sued them. And I still have that case going. But every year we have to add new elements because they do one illegal thing in 98, they do two illegal things in 99, and they keep increasing the illegality because they have the money and the power of corruption to buy off agencies, even buy off courts. The case of Percy Schmitzer is so clear about corruption of legal systems. I mean, that judgment, no normal justice could have written it. You know, a justice thinking of justice couldn't have written that judgment. It's only someone who got so much influence through the Monsanto argument where you can, he could actually argue, I'm sure all of you know about Percy Schmitzer's case, right? The Canadian farmer, whose fields were polluted and then he was sued. And the entire environmental principle of polluter pays was undone and polluter gets paid was established. The seeds that Monsanto tested for, Monsanto stole from Percy's farm. So when Percy's lawyer said, but you know, this evidence is not permissible because it's a result of stealing, and the justice rules that that's a lower form of property, you know, there's a higher form of property involved in intellectual property. And I was just thinking of Descartes all over again. You remember Descartes talked about that higher form of knowledge that comes from total disengagement? Where you break yourself so much from reality that you can talk, you can tell any lie and you don't have a way of testing its truth or falsehood. That's absolute truth for you. Yeah? Now, so we basically got a very Cartesian construction of intellectual property. And biopollution is coming to the assistance. You know, I used to think 5 years ago that there will be a I used to think there'll be a conflict between genetic pollution and intellectual property. Because here's something where I called it the ontological schizophrenia of the biotech industry. That, you know, when it came to pollution, they said it's just like nature. It's nothing new. And when it came to property, they said we made something absolutely new, so we must own it. So it was not novel. It was natural in terms of pollution, but it was not natural when it came to ownership of rights. And I thought these two were such strange concepts. They were going to come into a clash. And you know, but they're so smart. They're actually accepting pollution, but shedding responsibility for it, and instead claiming property rights on genes by spreading pollution. I always think it's like, you know, spreading mercury in the wells around here and saying the entire Pacific Grove belongs to me because my property mercury got into your well. Yeah? We haven't yet become so perverse that we would allow the mercury polluter rights over our land and water. But in the case of genetic pollution, we've allowed the genetic polluter rights over our genetic material, our seeds, our living resources. And I think something I think we need to be giving far more support to Percy Smyser in his case, because it is not Percy's case, it's humanity's case. It's species diversity case. So I think I hope one thing that will come out of this EcoFarm conference is a much stronger solidarity to transform that case into a case for all of us, especially in North America. The 1998, when Monsanto brought its first trials, and the trials were started in 40 sites in India, it was BT cotton. In its usual arrogance, Monsanto put this huge ad in newspapers saying, we're going to bring this new variety to Indian farmers called Bolgard, and you'll never ever need pesticides again. And by next year, it'll be in the market. Well, I knew Indian seed laws. You're supposed to have at least 2 seasons of quarantine and seed testing. I didn't know at that time that they violated the import laws and they violated the testing laws. But that they wanted to short-circuit the seed quarantine laws was so obvious. So we immediately declared, we said, no way are they going to have these seeds on the market next year. And our case was very, very important to stall the commercialization. Well, they managed the commercialization in March last year, in 2003. I usually kind of forget how time is moving so fast. 26th of March, Monsanto got a clearance. I want to give you a backdrop of what kind of context this was. They'd never have got that clearance in any normal period. One of the fallouts of 9/11 in countries that are very diverse and pluralistic, and India is extremely diverse, has been all kinds of polarizations created internally within society, some of it fed by political maneuvering, some of it fed by the Islamic phobia being fed around the world. At the end of February, we had very, very strong eruption of violence in the state of Gujarat, which is a western state. Throughout March, there were killings. More than 2,000 people were killed. Throughout March, we had religious rioting. And it's in that period where the country was totally preoccupied with religious conflict and with a government functioning literally on the verge of a fascist regime. Every progressive force in the country was trying to stop those killings. All of parliament was preoccupied with how to keep our pluralistic democratic fair fabric alive. And that's the time where they sneaked literally this clearance through. I just happened to be passing through Delhi on the day the meeting was called, because I do a lot of work across the country in conservation and with rural communities. I arrived in the morning, found out that this meeting had been announced. Not even half the committee members were present. Monsanto had already started giving press releases that they were going to get a clearance. The meeting hadn't been completed. By about 3 o'clock, there was a kind of vague clearance given. We said, you know, what are the terms? No official kid could give us the terms, which in India never happens. You know, our officials are so red tape oriented, they write everything down. An oral clearance, because this was timed to put pressure on the biosafety negotiations that were going to happen the next week in The Hague. It had less to do with India and more to do with the global situation, so they could cite that India too has gone the GMB. And if you read the report released, I think, 4 or 5 days ago by the ISAAA, which is a Cornell-based body of the biotech industry, they've talked about expanding acreage because that's the only thing they can count for themselves. They can't say more consumers are accepting this food. So they're showing expanding acreage as their only criteria of expansion of biotechnology. Now, what does this expanding acreage mean in the case of India? It means absolute failure of the BT cotton through this last growing season. But no one, we've done studies, in India, everyone knows the BT cotton has failed. It was planted on 40,000 hectares, about 95% of it has been a failure. But Monsanto waited till after the final crop has gone from the field, because if they say during the season, we can always take a journalist down to the field and say, see the state of this cotton. So they waited till the harvests are over to now come out with a fabricated report to say it's done wonderfully, and in the usual way, how much rupees has been saved, how much more yield has been achieved. Let me just give you figures from our survey. And we surveyed about 400 farmers who were growing BT cotton. The average yield, which was promised to be 15 quintals an acre, the average was down to 1.2 quintals. Yeah? On the average, farmers have lost 7,000 rupees an acre. On the average. Some have lost much more. Some have lost a little less. The quality itself is very, very inferior. The normal cotton, good quality cotton, has fiber of 32 millimeters. And the BT cotton, the fiber length is as little as 6 to 7 millimeters. And it's selling at half the price. So you've got about a tenth of the yield, and that tenth of the yield is selling at half the price. Even a conventional farmer is doing better. Of course, organic farmers would do much, much better. State after state, four states we've studied. In four states, Maharashtra, Andhra Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, Karnataka, very, very high losses as far as farmers are concerned. And every regional agriculture university has studies to show how bad it is. And they're saying, stop distributing the seed. But, you know, the decentralized agriculture system, which is closer to farmers, is saying one thing. Monsanto bribes at the Delhi level. So what they did was create an expert group that came back and said, it's done very well. Greenpeace, who's working very closely with us in India on the GM issue, they followed the expert committee. And I left in too much of a rush, otherwise I'd have carried with me the video they did. They went to the same farmers that the expert committee visited. And the farmers are saying, what they're saying, we said, we didn't say. Our crop has done very badly. So what, you know, the GM debate at this point, in my view, is really a debate about reinforcing the truth about its performance at the farmer's level. Now, I think the same issue applies to the United States. It's no different. Because the exaggerated claims constantly come from the company or from agencies they control. And we need to, I really think we need to spend the next few months consolidating the international data to show these promises were false. This is not what was delivered. There weren't reduced pesticide sprays. There isn't good weed control. In fact, there's already evidence of resistant weeds emerging in the herbicide-tolerant crops. This is how they're showing acreage increase while there's actually acreage failure. The 100,000 acres of India will be added to the next 100,000 acres because none of the farmers who planted this year are going to plant next year. So instead of saying minus 100, they're going to have plus 100 next year. That's how they're constantly managing to show a graph that's going that way on GM food. And they push this a lot to make it look like the decisions have been made and we have no choice. And I'm among those who believes that till you have 0.01% choice, you have obligation, you've got to keep acting. And things are never closed for you. The second level of coercion that's being applied, and I think it's a very important element on which we need global solidarity. In this case, we need global solidarity at the level of producers. And we need, I think we have the data. We have the data in our country. I know you have the data in your country. We need to make it global data that organic is the only way we're going to make it to support small farmers. There is no other way. At the level of consumers, since consumers who can choose are saying no, And that's one reason organic is actually growing in the industrialized countries, because people want a choice, and that's about the only exercise of choice that they can have. The way that choice is being attempted to be closed for the South is by pushing more and more. You know, globalization is first destroying the farmers and the small producers. In a country like India, 65 million tons of grain we have, and yet because of conditionalities linked to globalization, we've got increasing numbers hungry, and in fact our government committees are admitting that the increasing stocks are related to increasing declining consumption, not increased production. The less people are buying, the less people are eating, the more stocks are growing. So we've got huge surpluses now. 65 million tons of rice and wheat are rotting in the storehouses of India. And yet, more and more of our people, at the same time, are being made dependent on emergency food aid, precisely because the agriculture system is being made to collapse by the totally unjust laws of globalization, the WTO and the World Bank trade liberalization. And it's that food aid that is being transformed into a captive market for GMOs. Now, in 1999, I think it was, we had a big cyclone where 30,000 people died in Orissa. And Orissa is this eastern coastal state in India where people are rice eating. They eat rice at breakfast, they eat rice at lunch, they eat rice at dinner. If they have an evening tiffin, they eat rice again. And yet what they were getting for food aid was the corn soya blend. You know, it's got a new name. It's one more big campaign I've got to launch this year. They've just launched, and the biotech industry has just launched this crazy midday meal called India Mix. Yeah, and it is basically the GM mix of GM soya and GM corn. And fortunately, we've had movements in the past. We had a very strong women's action against GM soya imports or GM oil imports. When in 98 this was imposed on us. But in third world countries, it's not the case that people will just accept what's dumped on them. In Orissa, when the victims realized that the food they were eating, the reason we even did the test for them was they came and said, "We want rice, they're giving us this junk." I said, "What is it?" They said, "It was brought in a sack like this." So I saw the sack. It had nice stars and stripes on it. I took a bit of it and I sent it for testing, and of course we found it was GM, and we sent the results back to the victims, and the people said, "We're not going to eat this stuff." Now, you might know that last year, because of climate change, there's been a very, very bad drought in Africa. There was a very bad drought in India, it's continuing. As a result of which, about 15 million people in southern Africa as well as in the Horn of Africa are facing very severe problems. The World Summit on Sustainable Development was organized in Johannesburg in August. Just before that, a week before that, every agency of the world, World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, were brought in to say, Southern Africa must accept GM food aid. One by one, some countries started to give up, but Zambia didn't give in. And one reason Zambia didn't give in is Zambia has had, you know, there are few African countries which have tremendous negotiators who played a very good role during the biosafety protocol, which is a protocol under the Convention on Biological Diversity. And Lewonika, who's been a negotiator for Zambia, you know, 10 years, my God, anyone will become an expert in biotechnology. They took 10 years to allow that protocol to take shape. Because, you know, your administration tried to block it and block it and block it. So Lewonika knew everything. He knew every expert in the world. So when they started to dump, they basically said, "We want GM-free food aid." Colin Powell arrived at the World Summit and tried to say, "Beggars can't be choosers." And he was booed. And Europe turned around and said, "If Africa doesn't want GM, we're going to give them aid. We're going to give them money to buy GM free." Yeah? So at this point, you actually have Europe-Southern Alliance to reverse the spread, undemocratic spread of GMOs. And you've got little elements around the world, corrupted elements, you know, just like you've got mutant genes, you've got mutant elements in all our agencies. Yeah? Genetically engineered to be corrupt. And they're very few in number. But because they are backed by corporations that have no conscience, that are above the law, they are behaving as if they can't be stopped. That's our role. So remind corrupt scientists, corrupt government officials, that they aren't all powerful just because they have links with corrupt corporations. To show them that they are not all powerful is the ingenious strategies we create to roll back GMOs. The evidence we needed, you know, 10 years ago we used to worry about the risks these organizations could have. Today it's not a worry. We have the evidence. 10 years ago we weren't very sure. We said maybe they'll do better. Maybe they'll have higher yields. Maybe there will be more food. At that time we thought it's a trade-off between environmental and health risks and more production. There is no trade-off. There's less production, less reliability, more risks, higher costs. There's just a list of negatives to add up. There's nothing positive to show. So I think we need to be far more confident, and I think we need to be far more unified. I think it's time in the North for the movements on GMOs to stop being defensive movements. You know, they're still defensive movements. They need to be movements, like I said, they're not just movements about, I want safe food, I don't care about the rest of the world. It is about the rest of the world. I mean, no one can have safe food if the rest of the world doesn't have it. That's the stage we've reached. I was just reading at breakfast this morning a little snippet about the, you know, it looks like you are surrounded by bioterror. You know, and I'm not meaning the Monsanto-style bioterror. I'm meaning the other stuff they keep talking about, smallpox and this and that. And they're actually increasing the biosafety budget in your country where they said there's no risk because now they're stuck with having to talk about bioterrorism. I think we should be smart and turn it around. Yeah? Instead of letting bioterrorism becoming a tool for fear-mongering in ways to create hate against unknown people, we need to show there is bioterrorism and it's happening now. And we have a right to protect ourselves from it. How we organize about these things is totally up to small groups. But we can't escape solidarity. We just can't escape producer-consumer solidarity, we can't escape North-South solidarity, and we can't escape the scientist and citizen solidarity. I hope Ignacio does turn up. Has he turned up? No? Because I think, you know, people like Ignacio, any scientist who's done what they were supposed to do science rather than public relations, has been victimized. And Ignacio, you remember his Nature article and what happened to him. But in these 15 years, the best of scientists that I've known have had to pay a very high price. The worst of scientists are paraded around. Non-scientists are sold as experts. There's one guy who talks about feeding the world with plastics and pesticides. You can tell me his name. What's his name? Avery. BBC. He's always, you know, I have to deal with him over BBC, over the airwaves. I've never seen the man's face. But I think, you know, people like that should just not be allowed to pollute the airwaves. We've got a lot of work ahead of us. But I think, you know, we do not see enough of the vulnerability of the financial and scientific vulnerability that these corporations are in. And this country is the one which could literally pull the rug from under their feet. But that depends on how much confidence you have in the movement you're building. I have a lot in it. Thank you.
or just seeking a comment. There will be in June of this year, unless, as the USDA official said, the war breaks out, doesn't get over soon enough or whatever, an invitation has been issued by USDA and Veneman to every nation, except for four or five, to their agriculture officials, their environmental official, and their health official, to come to Sacramento in early June for really a hard sell of biotechnology. And so we are trying, a group of us have gotten together to try to have a little counter, an informative session. So partly ask Vonda to speak or comment a little bit about the symposium, if she knows about it, but mainly to let the people in this room know that many groups had a meeting in Oakland to discuss it. It's coming up very quickly, but it's our opportunity to get some press about the disasters that this technology has created in our own farming systems.
I think they want to keep everyone very busy in June, because isn't it the case that Bio also meets in Washington? Yeah. You know, they've been rehearsing this since last year, but the fact that they've got to do it so many times shows they're not getting too far. Because last June, they tried to hijack the World Food Summit, which is supposed to be about hunger, and hunger was forgotten. It became a biotech sales summit. Didn't get sold too well, because Zambia, in spite of it, blocked. And like I mentioned, India just ruled against the imports that couldn't be proven to be GM-free. And that's for our food aid, for our emergency food aid. I think these next few months are absolutely critical. I think we need to pull together all the material and synthesize it as a movement and have it available in this country. And you all need to do really strong media work, because once so many ministers will be here, and obviously the ministers they'll bring will be the ministers they've already influenced, who say, my country needs it, my country, my people are starving. We need to pull together everything that's available across Asia, Africa, Latin America, and make that, you know, long before the June meetings, make that circulate among citizens, groups, movements, as well as the media in this country. I hope there's some literature I've brought, the latest report we've done a series on the corporate hijack of agriculture, of food, of biodiversity, and of water. And then our newsletter, Bija has some recent write-ups that any of you who are campaigning can use.
Hi, I'm from Santa Cruz, and Percy Schmeiser came there a few months ago and told us that he had discovered that Monsanto and other biotech corporations have taken on a strategy of purposely contaminating farmers' fields. Have you found that to be a problem in India also? He said it was. He mostly heard of it in Africa and Canada where he was, but I was wondering about India.
Well, in the case of India last year, not last year, year before, 2001. Monsanto provided to our government evidence that a variety that had been grown on 10,000 acres was BT contaminated. Now, the seed company that sold that variety said, we have no idea there's BT in this. Only Monsanto had the DNA fingerprinting capacity to test. But in that particular case, and I want to read out the judgment of the courts and of the agency, of the government agency, the entire crop was uprooted. I personally believe that Monsanto had done that probably, you know, either deliberately contaminated or the contamination that had happened because of the open field trials, which had had no protection of any kind. The genetic engineering approval, the seed variety was called Navbharat 151. This is what our government agency that's supposed to be in charge of genetic engineering approval said. The crop which is standing may pass to the soil that modified genes which it contains. The effect on soil microorganisms cannot be estimated and may cause an irreversible change in the environment structure. It is a standard practice to uproot the crops, and then the government ordered uprooting and burning the entire crop of 10,000 acres. Our own feeling is that this was partly done because at that point, India had not changed its patent laws. And Monsanto could not use this to claim ownership over this crop. So they were more than happy to push for its destruction so that at that point, the pollution did not end up becoming their property. But now, our patent laws are changed. And the only change that has been made in May last year is a change that allows patenting on genetically engineered seed. There's no monopoly patents on medicine yet. No other change, only on genetically engineered seed. Just a few delicate clauses here and there, but you add it up and you know it's a Monsanto amendment is what I've called it. So yes, they definitely wherever they can, because they want a sense of hopelessness that you have no choice, you know. They want through pollution the idea spread that you have no choice. And that's precisely the mindset we have to avoid. We have to fight pollution. But we also have to stop feeling crippled because contamination has happened. We need to still, you know, I call it, you know, there are two notions of purity. There's a Brahmanical notion of purity, of untouchability, and there's the reasonable notion of purity, where you want to be pure, but you don't feel you're dead if somehow untouchability reached you. And I think we just need to be pragmatic. I mean, we need to keep fighting pollution, we need to keep making the companies accountable, and we need to keep fighting for the, you know, the one unsettled issue is the issue of liability, you know, the polluter pays principle in the case of genetic pollution. We've organized about four different events over the last year, including one just done in January with the victims of the Bhopal disaster. Yeah, it's 18 years because liability was never institutionalized. The 3,000 people then and 30,000 people since then who've lost their lives because of that one disaster. To us continue to be part of the, you know, the costs that are being generated by an industry that is the chemical industry and the biotech industry. So we joined the Bhopal issue because now Union Carbide is bought up by Dow, and Dow is among the big biotech players. And recently at the Asian Social Forum, we did a session called Beyond Bhopal and BT, Towards a Safe Future. And liability, of course, is the key issue. We need to keep, you know, I remember one of my favorite quotations is Kundera's, you know, the struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And I think for each new challenge we face, we need to bring all our past reserves of resistance to bear on it. Because no issue is a totally new issue. They carry all the past conflicts. And we're really up against one industry, which is the chemical industry, which we don't want for organic, the biotech industry, we don't want for organic, is the same guys who are selling hazardous drugs and wanting patents on medicine and selling medicines at 100 times the price that those medicines could be made. So they're killing us through food, and they're killing us through health, and they're killing us through toxics, and it's totally unnecessary. The health people were very, very smart at organizing around the issue of AIDS drugs, and in 6 months they created a global campaign to make these companies go totally defensive on the patenting issue and in the WTO TRIPS debate. And I think, you know, my own reading of it is, because we in the organic movement love localization so much, what happens is we try and become localized in our politics also. I think we need local farming and global politics. That's when we'll make the breakthrough. You know, one of the things that every human community anywhere in the world knew how to do is to do sustainable farming. Most places where there's hunger is where they were by one, for one reason or the other, made to stop those practices or prevent it from having those practices. India is such a clear case. There's two volumes of what we call the Ecological Food Atlas of India. It's a history of food and farming from the beginning of Indian recorded civilization to colonial times. And it's very, very clear. Every time we've had famines is when policies prevented farmers from feeding themselves. In the colonial times, it was because they extracted too much surplus. And our big movement at that time, which became part of our freedom movement, was for farmers to say, we need to keep enough to eat. Because 2 million people died in Bengal of a famine created by trade, where more exports of rice were happening to feed the war, and the people who'd grown that rice were starving to death. We got out of it, and the normal story you're told is the Green Revolution got us out of it. No, we got out of it because policies changed to defend the small farmer. We institutionalized land reform. No one could have giant-sized land holdings. Tillers became owners. The land to the tiller policy was implemented rigorously. Irrigation systems were supported. Public systems that support agriculture were put in place. Market systems to create, guaranteed markets, just prices, a universal food distribution, public food distribution, all that was put in place. Farmers started to do well, the country started to feed itself. And then again, globalization is trying to bring back the same policies that created the famines of 1942. And we started to have the beginnings of hunger and starvation deaths emerge. I've just completed a hearing, public hearing, and I had a government commissioner come to report that in the regions which he governs, the deaths of infants between the 0 to 6 age group, which used to be caused because of lack of food, was zero at the beginning of the globalization period, which is 91. And today it's 47%. 47% infants are dying of lack of food today, when none of them were dying for lack of food. They died because of other reasons for lack of food, just in a decade. So I don't think, I want to have the 5 minutes that it would take me to do a calculation that if the world's agriculture was crippled and everyone had to depend on U.S. industrial agriculture, there just wouldn't be enough food in the world at all. There'd be massive scarcity. The assumption is no Chinese farmer should grow food for China. The assumption is no Indian farmer should grow food for India. The assumption is also no African farmer should grow food for Africa. You add it all, not organic, not industrial farming in this country would feed the world. So we need to be sure that the food systems, and that's why we talk of food sovereignty, that the food systems of each region are made as resilient as possible. But meantime, while the crisis is there, I would say let's have a campaign on organic fooding. It's all right. I think it's worth it because I really believe that transition arrangements are fine, And very often in movements, it's again that Brahminical notion of purity. Yeah? We want to go there, but we are here. And we insist that unless you can have the pure form of being there, you won't even step there. The road has a bit of this and that. We've got to deal with it, this and that. My involvement with the issues of WTO and globalization really started because of the issue of intellectual property. I started to read the Dunkel, it used to be called the Dunkel draft text, this was way back, 91, the Uruguay round had been completed, and the director general of the GATT at that time was a person called Arthur Dunkel. And one phrase that is very common in these dictatorial agencies is, they prepare a text, they say this is a democratic decision of member countries, but the secretariat prepares a text, and they call it a take it or leave it text. You got to sign on it without any change. And when this text was brought to India, it wasn't brought to India democratically. So, some of us managed to get copies through our negotiators. We called it DDT, the Dunkel draft text. And we encouraged our farmers to start treating it just like DDT. It's a very, very toxic document and a very toxic treaty. And since that time, in 91, we organized rallies. We had 500,000 peasants out on the street. Because when we laid out to them what this treaty involved, that it would allow patenting on life, it would allow monopolies on seed, there's not a single person in India who accepted. So we started to say then that we will do with these laws, if they ever come into force, what Gandhi did with the salt laws of the British. So we started the notion of a Bij Satyagraha. Bij means seed. And its roots are in Ja is life, and Bija is that which from which life arises again and again and again. That's the definition of seed. That's why to us terminator seed is not seed anymore. It doesn't qualify for seed. The seed should regenerate. Seed, by definition, should reproduce on its own terms. And our Bij Satyagraha is basically a preparation to not cooperate. Navdanya, the movement I started, the ninth, you know, called Nine Seeds, which is basically to save seeds, but it's a political movement. From the day we started it, every member who joins Navdanya, every farmer signs a pledge saying, I will save this seed and I will save it as common property and I will save it in the public domain and I will never ever obey a law that turns it into private property. I will never ever be made fearful for sharing and saving seed. We do that literally day in and day out in our work. And I at least pledge to myself that we will not let a Percy Spicer case happen in our country. We've already declared non-cooperation. 10 years of non-cooperation. And the government has had to, in every law, add a clause. The farmers' rights will never be touched. They've had to add those clauses. So when the companies will bring those cases, those other clauses will come into play. So because we had 10-year movements, the governments could not just say absolute monopolies on seed. But I personally feel it's not just third world countries. I think around the world, we need to have a very, very strong reclaiming of the commons and the public good and the public domain, whether it's in software or it's in knowledge or seeds. I think this is, to me, this is the year of agriculture. This is the year of reclaiming the commons. And, you know, there's lots of work ahead of us.
Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking last January at the 2003 EcoFarm Conference. Thanks to Frank Moore and Michael LaBoche for that material. And also thanks to S. Mann of Forest Park Community College in St. Louis, Missouri, and Stephen Christoph at CKUT Montreal for their contributions to the program today. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us through our website, www.unwelcomeguests.org. We'd love to know who's listening and what your thoughts are.
But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle.